Hare Krishna. Today on Shat Til Ekadashi, here in the glorious abode of the Lord, Sri Rangam, I now plan to address a few queries that were pending after our recent blissful Shravan Kirtan camp here. Here's the first one. It's a common question. It is stated in Bhagavad Gita that women are considered in the papa yoni, born in a sinful situation. Yeah, that verse is there at, toward the end of the ninth chapter of Gita. Mam hi partavya parshritya yepi syuf papa yoni ha striyo vaishastata shudrastepiyanti param gatim. So why is it that? Why are women considered papa yoni? Well, first of all, we have to understand that punya, piety, and papa, sinfulness, are relative terms in as much as basically everyone in this material world is sinful. To be in this situation, it means we've turned away from Krishna. But within that basically sinful situation, some are pious. Some situations are conducive or favorable for making advancement to paramgati, the ultimate goal of life. That is called pious. And those who are inclined to that, and those who are not inclined to that, or those who have acted sinfully in previous lives, they take birth in a lower situation. Lower situation means it's less conducive toward going toward the ultimate goal of life. So the lower births, those of Vaishyas and Shudras, they are less conducive for spiritual advancement, as is that of the woman. The mentality that comes with that birth, with that attitude, the brahmanas and kshatriyas, they're strongly committed to dharma. The shastra is their compass. Less so for the Vaishyas, and hardly for the Shudras. Women, another reason they're called Papa Yoni, that's described in Bhagavatam. They are participants in the sinfulness of Indra, who meted out to them the results of his impious activities, his sinful activities. So it's not that the Atma or the Jiva is intrinsically sinful, but according to his or her activities, you get a certain birth. Human birth is higher than non-human, because it's more suitable for spiritual realization. Within that, there are gradations. And the woman's birth is less conducive for spiritual realization. However, in this verse, Krishna says that despite prior eligibility, possession of or lack of prior eligibility, those who take shelter in me, they come to the supreme destination. So it's not in and of itself a disqualification. Are women who are in Krishna conscious movement, are they sinful? No. Anyone who takes to Krishna conscious becomes cleared of all sins. Of course, it's possible even after coming to Krishna conscious to again commit sin. So that's not a very high-grade devotee. But that's possible for men and for women. So anyone who comes to Krishna conscious, we shouldn't consider them sinful, although we tend to be influenced by our previous sanskaras or impressions in our mind. In other words, it's not that simply by taking to Krishna consciousness, we immediately become completely free from influences of the mind and the body that we have inherited from previous lives. So within Krishna consciousness also there are prescribed rules to be followed. It's generally recommended to follow the Varnashram system, and as Srila Prabhupada once said, woman is woman, man is man. So that it's not that because anyone who takes to Krishna consciousness is glorious in comparison to those who don't take to Krishna consciousness. It's not that men and women have exactly the same roles. Another question. In Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna mentions the name of Devala as an authority who accepted Krishna as supreme. However, in one of the purports in the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, that's canto 1, chapter 9, purport to text 6 and 7, Devala is mentioned as a devotee of Lord Shiva. How to reconcile this? That shouldn't be very difficult if we consider that many people have the same name, even today in India. How many men have the name Ramesh, Suresh, Satish? So in the long, long history of this sacred land, there may have been many, or at least two rishis who had the name Devala, one of whom accepts Krishna as supreme, and another who is known as a devotee of Lord Shiva. Then another question, what will happen to a person if he distributes intoxication, in particular coffee, tea, chocolate, as directed by a senior devotee who has been given by his spiritual teacher? This sounds completely bizarre, considering that in our Krishna conscious movement, intoxication, coffee and tea included, are completely forbidden. Chocolate seems to be a borderline case. I don't personally recommend taking, offering, or distributing chocolate, but as I say, it's a borderline case. But what will happen if someone, especially after taking the vow to not take intoxication, not only takes himself, but encourages others who have come to take to Krishna consciousness to indulge in such intoxicants, well, certainly nothing very auspicious happens. Their Krishna consciousness is blocked. That must happen. And one becomes offensive by disobeying the order of the spiritual master and becomes sinful. Taking tea and coffee is not major or grossly sinful as taking wine or meat, but it's also forbidden in our Krishna conscious movement. Another question, should we also remember the form of the Lord, Rupa Dhyan, while chanting the holy name? Is it considered the best way to chant? Actually, this question is asked so many times. There's a nice seminar on chanting the holy names of the Lord, English with Tamil translation. That's on the ISKCON Salem website about chanting japa. Srila Prabhupada recommended that in the beginning we should chant the holy names and hear the sound, knowing the name of Krishna to be non-different from Krishna. It's also very good to sit in front of a picture of Krishna while chanting the holy names. Sitting in front of Tulsi is especially remembered. But making a particular effort to fix the form of the Lord within the heart while chanting is not recommended. It's recommended to... That may spontaneously develop at a more advanced stage, but in the beginning, one is recommended to try to fix the form of the Lord in the form of the sound of his names. Now, this is going over to some practical matters we can say of how to... Oh, there's another one which I don't see here, but I remember it because it really struck me. It's not written. I don't have it here. I don't have the exact words, but I remember the gist is that what do we do as grihasthas if we're living among non-devotees and then our children, it's very difficult to train them because they go naturally, they play with the children, or they want to mix with the children of other people in the houses next to them, and in the other houses people will give them chocolates to eat and they'll watch TV. What do we do? Do we be unsocial, antisocial with the people all around us and restrain our children, or do we keep a good relationship with everyone and lose all our principles? It just shows how it's very, very difficult to live among non-devotees. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said it's better to live in a cage surrounded by fire. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu quoted from Shastra. It's better to live in a cage surrounded to fire than to remain with persons who are inimical to the service of Krishna. Very, very difficult, because on the one hand we can't compromise our principles, on the other hand it is very difficult to fight with people all the time, and then our children will probably rebel against us anyway if we don't allow them to have all the sense gratification that they see everyone else around them having. So what to do? The best thing is to move into a devotee community, either on a farm or in the city, if there is in the city such facility. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada wanted to make devotee communities. He was very pleased and encouraged in Los Angeles, where the devotees purchased the houses all around the temple. He recommended doing that in the village of Lechmore Heath, near London, where that's the place where Bhaktivedanta Manor stands. That building was kindly purchased by George Harrison for the use of the devotees. So best thing is to move as soon as possible for your own sake and that of your children. And of course, that might not be very practical advice for all grihasthas. Might be easier said than done. So what can you do under the circumstances? Do the best you can. Bring your children to the temple once a week, or simply go on with your spiritual practices and try to induce your children to do them. Discuss with other devotees in a similar situation how they handle the situation. And really, it's a major responsibility of the leaders of this movement to develop Vaishnav communities where devotees can live, and even not just living arrangements, but economic arrangements, so that everyone... That's Varnashram was the system that Srila Prabhupada wanted to establish. Farm communities, simple living and high thinking. So as far as possible, get into such a community. If not, just do the best you can. Trying to force your children while work, you can preach to them, restrict them, try to explain to your neighbors, try to make your neighbors devotees. Now, another question about joining farms. Most of the grihasthas who had decent paying jobs have created some assets before they joined a farm. These senior devotees encourage us also to join a farm and stress that there is no need to create any asset before making a move. Does it not create a kind of disparity, dependent or independent family? I have a desire, but I am confused if I should earn a little more before I join. Now, if I think of the short history of our farm community projects here in India. Let me see, the first three families who moved, that's Nata, Gauranga, Tribhangananda, and Nityananda Krishna and their families. They were all in well-paying jobs. I'm not sure, but probably they had have some savings and some assets. So you might say they're in a better position than others who don't have savings, because just in case everything collapses, they have something to fall back on if the farm community doesn't work. Well, the farm communities are working, that one that they started with. And in some ways, those who join without assets, they're in a better position. They're in a position of, they have nothing to fall back on. Therefore, they have to fall back on, depend on Krishna's mercy by living on the farm. But no, it's by the mercy of these devotees who have pioneered the farm communities. Now devotees can join and facilities are there, and you don't have to have any backup or assets. So you can join. You don't have to wait and spoil more of your life. If the opportunity is there, you can join. Actually, there's a waiting list to join. So if you're on the waiting list, or you can get on the waiting list, and in the meantime, if that satisfies you, you can get some savings. But really, the idea is to depend on the land, the cows, and Krishna. The land gives us food. We can't depend on the savings. The government can just neutralize all that by, or deflate the value of the money in our bank account by devaluing the currency. Sometimes governments do that. Overnight, they devalue the currency. I remember in England when I was a child, there was a huge thing. The government devalued the currency, which meant that overnight, everyone had less money than they had the previous day. Or they can put so many taxes. Now there are so many taxes. There's general sales tax, incomes tax, this tax, that tax, or whatever you earn, it's all being taken away anyway. So living on the land is Krishna's way to live, that he gave us for the majority of people. So take advantage. Anyway, the point is, you don't have to build up some assets. If you feel you have to, you can do if you like, but then you probably won't be such a good candidate for living on the farm anyway, if you think that it's by money that we live instead of Krishna's mercy. Then you may not be such a good candidate for the farm. Now here's something I don't have as a written question, but something I want to address from the recent Shravan Kirtan camp. That a young man, almost 30 years old, when you're twice that age, 30 seems quite young. He is in a debt trap. He owes the government money. He's from Malaysia, owes the government money for his studies, and it'll take him 15 years to pay this off. He's caught. He has to go on working as a doctor for 15 years, and then he can pay this off. He doesn't want to marry, doesn't want to get entangled. But I advised him that, as according to Shastra and tradition, one should not remain unmarried if one is not living as a brahmachari. Now, his whole idea is to avoid the entanglement, which is understandable because married life is entangling and we want to become free from all material entanglements. We want to concentrate on Krishna. On the other hand, his whole situation, he is entangled anyway, and he's not able to live as a brahmachari. If one can live as a brahmachari, that means brahmachari gurukule. Actually, brahmachari actually lives in an ashram and dedicates himself fully to spiritual activities. and in this way is able to serve human society by giving spiritual knowledge to society or by worshipping the deities so that people can come and take darshan of the beautiful deities. So, although it's a fact that Grihastha Ashram has its entanglement, but it's also a form of service. If you're not able to serve the mission of Srila Prabhupada and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as a brahmachari, then one should serve as a grihastha, because that's also a service, to give shelter to a Vaishnavi, a female devotee. There are so many female devotees who need to be married. It's also a service to the whole Vaishnav society by bringing forth Vaishnav or children or children to be trained as Vaishnavas. And it also a service to those jivas who are waiting to be placed in the wombs of Vaishnava mothers. So the point is, everyone is meant for some service. So if you can't serve as a brahmachari, you can serve as a grihastha. If you enter grihastha ashram now, then you can do that service. Otherwise, one's whole work, it's just passing time. But if one is working but not married, he's just passing time until he reaches the age where he can become free from all of this. But if one is married, then he's not just passing time, he's also doing the service of maintaining a family, maintaining some Vaishnavas. If you're not able to administer to the broader human society as a brahmachari, then at least you administer to a few like that. Marry now and then have a few children, and then within a little more than 15 years you should be ready to renounce. Anyway, otherwise you should be able to renounce, become a vanaprastha like that, having trained some children in Krishna consciousness. On the other hand, if one doesn't marry, one is always in a dangerous position, because you're dealing with materialistic people in a materialistic atmosphere, and the power of Maya is very strong, and the danger of becoming entangled even against one's own wishes is very strong. So it's better to take that precaution and marry and be sheltered. The husband shelters the wife, and the wife shelters the husband. A good husband and a good wife help each other advance in Krishna consciousness. So, anyway, you're entangled. So, make the best use of a bad bargain. Use that entangled situation to serve Krishna and the mission of Srila Prabhupada in this way. I also mentioned the story of Priyavrata, which is given at the beginning of the fifth canto of Bhagavatam, who wanted not to marry but was forced by the order of higher authority, the guru of his guru, Lord Brahma, that he should marry and take responsibility in the material world. And then later, he went back to his, having done that, and he went back to his renounced life. Hare Krishna.